Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, here we are in the woods still, but the woods is a pretty good place to be. Remembering our frame story of right now, Saturn opposite Pluto until May 25th. And basically, Saturn's structure of world opposite Pluto says to us, change or die. What must we die to if we're not to die from it? We say all oppositional face-off, all us, them. So we know that all systems are under stress and therefore collapsing in order to restructure. It's as though the Twin Towers is an ongoing tarot card, too, health structure, all kinds of things, an admonition. So, but now, really, right now, we say Saturn opposite Pluto, but now Saturn trines Neptune. And it really does say, visionary activist principle number one, that imagination lays the tracks for the reality train. Setting our intention now makes the manifestation of vision easy. It wants to happen. And Saturn is at 8 degrees of Gemini right now, the midheaven for KPFA when Pacifica was born, April 15th, 1949, is 8 degrees of Gemini. So if astrology were anything to go by, we'd go, ooh, what a tremendous, momentous, pivotal point in the history of KPFA to gather its attention, refocus its vision. We're also right now, when we say long-term vision, it's certainly something missing in the world. Long-term vision seems to mean yesterday or today, and we want to stretch it way out, 2012 and beyond. Today also is we're on the eve, the afternoon, and then the eve of Mercury, messenger trickster god stationing, and then we'll retrograde tomorrow at 12:50 p.m., retrograde from January 18th until February 8th. So Mercury retrograde says go back, renegotiate, re-talk, reconnect, rethink, And Saturn, the form god, in a sense, standing on top of KPFA Pacifica's midheaven, meaning its antenna, what it sends out into the world, its message, is now retrograde, meaning return, rededicate, go back to the original vision. It goes direct February 7th. So this time period right now through February 7th, February 8th, high time of very positive strategy. So we remember at the end of the Russian Revolution that the Makhnovists, the anarchists in the Ukraine, were the only really prospering community afterwards because their attitude was, we have this vision. Please come join it if you want, and if you don't, we won't kill you. So they were the only domain in Russia after the revolution that actually had doctors and functioning systems, and most people did choose to join in. What was their defeat was Trotsky said, you have the best army, come turn it in. And the Makhnovists said, no. And Trotsky said, well, then come for a meeting. And they said, okay, and he killed them all. So it wasn't that they didn't have the right idea about the all-inclusive invitational vision. And what's also on our table right now, too, is that two images I want to put forth. The image for KPFA Pacifica's midheaven, its antenna, its message, is a quiver filled with arrows, hitting the mark, getting to the point, being sharp, progressively approximating one's goal, meeting challenges, taking things on with a flair, training one's sights, overcoming misdirection. Pluto, the change, rebirth, restructure, woofy, fierce underworld guy, its Sabian symbol, its image for right now is an Easter sunrise service, new mornings, renewal of hope, sharing a dream, dramatic comebacks, darkest hour before the dawn behind one, inner vitality winning out over outer circumstance, joyous rediscovery of mission. So, addressing our own beloved Pacifica, we say it's a fractal, it's a micro-experiment. It wants to be the voice for the strongest cultural movement of dynamic peace this country has ever seen. And it's an opportunity to be the culture we aspire to create. So, perfect guest today, here to help us gather our wits and tell our story of past, present, and future is Dave Adelson. Let's see, there's many ways to introduce him, but Dave, maybe you should just jump in right now, which is Dave Adelson.
Adelson's better.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. It's good to be on with you, Carolyn. Thank you.
So,
I'll tell you, I got goosebumps when you were talking about those concepts of renewal, the overcoming misdirection, because the misdirection that people have been subjected to, the people who are listening with respect to what's happening at this unique place in media, is just been staggering. And it's been going on for so long that it's going to be a remarkable unleashing of I don't want to sound overly dramatic, but truth and creative energies coming up as people realize what's going on. Because one of the things I think that happens when you wake up from a long period of misdirection is you find out that a lot of the reasons you were bumping into walls was you were heading into the corner, not down an open path. And when you find out what's been going on, you see things clearly, you see what was happening, then you can suddenly start walking down an open path. And I think the experience is going to be incredible.
Well, let's go backwards in order to go forwards just a little bit to introduce yourself to our audience. Many know you, but it was really in 1997, yes, you were a member of the Pacifica Board.
I was on the local advisory board. I've been on the local advisory board at KPFK since the middle of 1996. And I had been a volunteer in the newsroom teaching them internet skills in 1995. After I'd finished my degree, I'd been listening to KPFK for a number of years, and it had really changed my life, and I felt like I owed some work back to it, because it occurred to me that the things that were being said on the air, if what I was hearing was true, then KPFK and Pacifica generally was a real threat to established power and abuse of authority, and therefore that it would need the work of people who'd been changed by it to be able to survive. So I wanted to go and do what I could to help. And in the course of being in the newsroom there, I noticed that there were a lot of things going on that seemed to me really different than the kind of rhetoric I heard on the air about openness. In fact, there seemed to be a distinct lack of openness, but I didn't really understand it at the time. And that concern was really peaked in 1996 in February when I heard some African-American programmers talking on a program called Continent to Continent, which was an African and African-American issues news magazine done by Ron Wilkins that I liked a lot, about how black and brown programmers were being purged from Pacifica and what was going on at Pacifica. And they were cut off in mid-program by the general manager down here, Mark Shubb, after an email exchange with him in which he claimed that they had set him up and that they had never come to him with their grievance and that it was an absolute rule that people shouldn't take their dirty laundry to the air and that Ron was tired of doing his show and that it was a cynical attempt to manipulate the consciousness of the listeners and all the rest. And after this email exchange I had with him, the next day a notice went up in the station that said, I just want to remind everybody that there is an absolute rule against airing dirty laundry, and this includes event announcements, by which he meant you could not only not discuss internal policy on the air, but you couldn't announce events in the community at which these things would be discussed. And that these things that were important and crucial to be discussed were a fundamental change in the model of broadcasting at Pacifica. And it was a fundamental change that had also gone on throughout non-commercial radio for at least the 10 years prior and had been described really clearly in an article in 1992 called Why Public Radio Isn't. It was a stereotypic process for basically moving from a diverse, crazy quilt community participatory model in which you had a lot of different audiences and a lot of different participants to one in which you were engaged in target market programming, which was intended to increase the listening time and therefore the donation rate of a core market of listeners. And that dynamic was exactly contrary to what Lou Hill had described in his essays about why Pacifica was created. It was created, according to him, and Matthew Lazar, who's chronicled it, has said at various times that he did tell different stories about the fundamental reasons for its creation to different audiences. Some audiences he felt couldn't take hearing that it was primarily created to speak out against war. But in any case, he said that the reason that you didn't get ethical communication in the most powerful communications medium was that people were put in front of the microphone to deliver an audience, to manage an audience, and that therefore there couldn't be tolerance for the risks people had to take in order to achieve brilliance, for the exploration that needed to happen with the listeners to get to places that were other than just you know, that which was expected based on what you've heard before. In any case, we can talk more about that in a little bit. But I just want to get quickly to the fact that shortly thereafter, I joined the local advisory board. I found out there were a number of problems. I didn't really understand the root of them until I found a website started by Lynn Geary in the fall of 1996. And ultimately, I learned that there were attempts at the level of the entire institution to change the way the governing board elected itself and possibly to sell one of the station licenses in order to fund this model of professional programmers engaged in serving a core audience with consistent programming. And that was 1997. So the stuff that happened to KPFA beginning in 1999 had roots that stretched back 6 years at least, which I think a lot of your listeners may know about. But why don't I shut up and let you ask me what you want?
Well, no, I just want to add an embroider, and in the spirit of the arrow, the quiver filled with arrows, to go backwards, to go forwards too. We'd say that, you know, discrepancy does lead to instability, and that. And as we want to report also from the board meeting of last weekend, the gag rule is lifted. And I always thought it was curious, the phrase airing dirty laundry as a kind of Victorian, you know, taboo, like, ooh, don't air your dirty laundry. It's such a sexually repressive kind of phrase that in its essence it just, you know, completely sort of expresses its contradiction, going, oh.
Well, there is an element to that. We are going to impose force on you. We are going to violate you, and you may not tell anybody. That was
right.
Something that was really remarkable and upsetting to me.
Yes, and then, but we do want to continue with your narrative and also bring us up to report on last and let callers come in too. But then you published an article in Z Magazine in 97, yes?
Yes, in June of 1997. First of all, there were groups in Berkeley, a group called Take Back KPFA, headed up by a number of people, Jeff Blankfort, Mariah Gallardon, Kirk Gray, I think Les Radke was involved, Mary Berg, I don't know the entire roster, but they had been protesting the reformatting of KPFA's air, the removal of longtime programmers, and basically the institution of this more stripped model of programming. And they and others had Take Back KPFA in particular, had made a complaint to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because the Pacifica Board was holding its meetings in executive session in violation of open meetings requirements of the Communications Act. They had a meeting that was scheduled for Houston that got moved to Galveston in February of 1997, or it may have been the fall of 96. But in any case, it was clear that one of the topics under discussion was a change in bylaws. I found out about it in a local board meeting, KPFK local board meeting, in January of 97. And I also learned from one of our national board members at the time that one of the things at issue was this difference in vision about whether or not to sell WBAI. Our manager commented that in the past it couldn't even be discussed. It was so taboo as a topic, but now it could at least be discussed. There were other manipulations going on that I felt having to do with the roster of the National Board at the time. And anyhow, in that meeting that was held out in Galveston and was from which the public was excluded, there were discussions about how to reconfigure the way the National Board was elected. And people should know that Pacifica's a 501c3 nonprofit educational corporation foundation, and the National Board historically, although it had been a sort of placeholder entity, it had never really had, to my understanding, that much authority over what happened at the individual stations, that there was a high degree of local autonomy. But beginning with Pat Scott's regime and David Salniker's regime, who was the, that history is before my time, so I want to say he was chair of the board. I know he had been general manager at KPFA, but I don't exactly know his role at that time because it was before I came on. But in any case, these people were involved in arguing that Pacifica was irrelevant, by which I think they meant that their audiences were also irrelevant to them, and that it had to be modernized, and that they were going to begin to impose this modernization. So for the first time, a great deal more central control than had ever been experienced before. And as part of that, and as part of the changes that were being made, there were attempts to of the National Board to get control of its own composition, because for the first time, that composition was really going to mean a lot and matter a lot for what would happen and at Pacifica, and also what would happen once the listeners started finding out, because it was hard to break through this dirty laundry rule to let the listeners know. And the plan was to change, at the time, the local boards elected two-thirds of the national board. There were 15 seats, and each local board, which were themselves self-electing, elected two of their own members to serve on the national board, and the national board chose five at-large members, and they had one open at-large seat that they hadn't been able to fill, and I was told in part that was over conflict about the vision for the BAI situation and the question of selling. At that time, to seat an at-large member, you had to get a two-thirds majority of those who were on the board. So you either had to be, to get on the board, you had to either be elected by your LAB by a simple majority or elected by the national board by a two-thirds majority. Anyhow, they wanted to change that so that each local board would only nominate two people, and they would choose one of those two people, and then they'd additionally select another person from the signal area in addition to the at-large people. So they would get direct control over two-thirds of their membership and elective control over the remaining third. And basically, so I published an article. I was contacted by Michael Albert of Z in March of 97, and he asked me if I would, and he talked to me a while about what was going on, and I explained to him as best as I understood it what it looked like was going on. And he asked me if I'd write an article, and I said no. And he asked again, he said, please, you know, will you do this? I am getting calls from all sorts of people, and nobody will go on record on this because they're afraid of what's going to happen to them. The reason I had said no was I'd only been on the board for about 9 months, and I was still of the belief that this was something that could be negotiated, that maybe there was misunderstandings. It was clear that different stories were being told to different groups, that people were being told what they wanted to hear, and I thought if the case could be made to people who were being misled, that things would change. I agreed to publish the article because I felt that there was no other way to get the word out. And I was naive enough to think that once people realized what was going on, there would be this mass response that would, you know, bring everything back to, bring some sunshine to it and stop the process. Because although they were telling, you know, our manager was telling me I was crazy and that most listeners didn't care at all about internal issues and that the prior programming was just a waste of the air and that they were going to revitalize and improve the air and all this, but basically that no listeners would share my view. Well, my experience is that whenever the people have found out about it, they similarly become alarmed about what was being done. And anyhow, so I thought when the word got out, there'd be this huge response. Well, there was some response, and because of the response to the article and to the activism of a lot of people on the ground, the board delayed the key change in the bylaws from the June 97 meeting to the fall of 97. And by the way, at the time they had hired this first ever PR director, a guy named Bert Glass, who'd formerly been with the community-oriented policing program of the U.S. Justice Department, essentially PR flack. And he had published this memorandum, this private memorandum, to key national personnel in February of 97. And you can find it on the web if your listeners go to do a search for the term cheat sheet and Pacifica. They'll find it on the radioforall.org website. And they should look it up because it's a study in spin and how to distract people, how to misdirect, which was what caught me in your opening statements. And for one thing, he had a before and after scenario for what to tell people about this governance change. And he said, well, before the governance change happens, or before it's announced, tell them we don't know what we're doing. And after it's announced, tell them that, well, we had to deal with getting more skills on the board. I forget the exact language. But anyhow, it was clear that they knew what they were going to do, and this was just a way of misleading listeners when they asked. Anyhow, so they delayed the key change in the bylaws from June of 97 to the fall of 97, and in the fall of 97, Mary Frances Berry was seated on the board. Now, a lot of people seem to think
How did that happen?
It was interesting. They had two candidates. Jack O'Dell had been the chair of the board for 20 years in violation of Pacifica's bylaws, which said that you could only serve two consecutive terms, and then they modified that rule after the fact to say you could serve up to four terms if you had different positions on the board. That was the cover for Roberta Brooks, Ron Dellum's aide, who had served past the term allowed in the bylaws. They did a lot of this stuff of just extending terms. Anyhow, Jack O'Dell announced his resignation at the June 97 meeting, and they had to pick a replacement chair. And the two candidates were Dennis Rivera, who was a union guy from New York, and Mary Frances Berry. And I forget, Jack O'Dell recommended one and Pat Scott the other, and I forget who made which recommendation. But I seem to remember that Pat was backing Dennis Rivera and Jack was backing Mary Frances Berry. Neither one could get a two-thirds majority as chair. So what they did was they elected both to the board as at-large members, and then appointed. Then it only took a simple majority to make Mary chair, and Dennis ultimately turned down the position. So she took over the chairship. And what I want to emphasize is that she came in about 4 to 5 years after this entire trajectory had been set in place. And one of the reasons I was concerned about the trajectory was that it seemed to me that the people who were, quote, taking over had a little bit of, I mean, they seemed to want to be players, and they were restructuring the institution in a way that they would get played, that real players would come in and take what they thought they had just won right away from them. And ultimately, that's what happened. The people who were the architects of the reconfiguration, the centralization, and the rest of it eventually all got driven out between 1997 and 1999. The last of the people to get driven out was Sandra Rosas, the controller, I think a year to a year and a half ago. But in any case, so Mary was seated, and some community groups, and along with some luminaries like Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Helen Caldicott, community groups like Take Back KPFA, Pacific Accountability Committee in L.A., Save Our Station in New York, people who had been really marginalized and derided by the administration as being a bunch of crazy, looped-out activists. They sent Dan Siegel to observe the meeting in D.C. and basically to threaten suit if they tried to change their bylaws, because there had been some issues about notice requirements and also some real sketchy stuff done with extending terms improperly and the rest. So at that meeting, instead of changing the bylaws to change the way the board was elected, they increased the number of at-large seats from 5 to 9. But they actually did change the bylaws. They changed a key clause. It used to say, the bylaws previous to that had said that in order to be elected, a member must receive a majority vote of the nomination and vote of a majority of the LAB which he or she represents, unless such member is an at-large member, in which case they must receive a two-thirds majority. And they changed that to say that the LAB shall nominate two people. And I think they also may have changed, again, my memory's foggy on this, changed the rule that, and said that at-large members could be elected by simple majority. But the reason that change in the language about LABs was important was that even though the LABs were still sending two people, the change from the word vote, nomination and vote, and in order to be elected, to the LABs nominate, essentially stripped the corporate membership rights of LABs, because LAB members were not members explicitly in the articles of incorporation. They had membership by virtue of the fact that they had the right to elect the directors. In California Corporations Code, if you have the right to elect a director, that right cannot be stripped from you or from a group who has the right to elect without that group's consent. So that was actually a key change, and we are lucky that a year and a half later, they only waited a year and a half before they went back to try and change the bylaws again, this time arguing that they were being threatened with defunding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in order.
Is that a fiction?
Well, I can describe it really easily. What happened was, but let me just finish with this prior point, which is if they hadn't tried that then, therefore triggering the lawsuit that we brought, it took a couple of months after they did that in February of 99 to organize the LABs to get the suit filed. But if they hadn't done that, if they just waited another year or two, then the statute of limitations, or I don't know the technical legal term, would have run out. You only have 3 years to file a complaint if somebody does something like an illegal change in bylaws. So the moment that the LAVs were disfranchised was really the fall of 1997. And if they had waited a couple more years, we wouldn't have had standing to sue, because we wouldn't have been corporate members, because our rights to elect would have been withdrawn and nobody would have noticed. So we're actually very lucky that they wanted to push so hard.
So things are going well.
Yeah, I mean, talk about kismet, right? But anyhow, what had happened was then, so they backed off this attempt to change the contribution of LABs to the national board, except that they'd reduced it from 67% to 54% by expanding the number of at-large members. And then in Houston, at the Houston and by the way, I actually had some confidence in Dr. Berry, because the first time she started making people, for example, post the minutes of meetings and the transcripts of meetings. She made people start following rules. But very soon after that, like by the following fall, first of all, in the spring of 98, we got a change in the local rules governing the local boards, such that staff who were sitting on boards got their voting rights removed. And again, it was clear to me that that was about jockeying for who would be elected to the national, so that national could get two-thirds of people who would be willing to vote in a way that the control clique wanted them to. When I say the control clique, by the way, another of the violations of that board was that they were appointing people to the executive committee when the bylaws required that people be elected to the executive committee, and it was the executive committee that had control over the executive director and operations in between board meetings. So that was a very important committee. Some other things that they were doing also was prevent when certain directors tried to get information, like Rob Robinson tried to get information about finances sometime later, he was refused, and directors have an absolute right to see any financial document of the foundation that they request. But in any case, so in Houston, in the fall of 1998, Mary Berry presented the board with a letter that Robert Coonrod, who's the head of the, who was the head, he may still be, of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, had written in response to a solicitation by Pat Scott, who was the former executive director. And she basically inquired whether or not Pacifica's structure, in which local boards elected governing boards, was in violation of any CPB rules. CPB had just reissued its regulations concerning grantees, and they hadn't changed anything, and the Communications Act law governing that had not changed. But she took the opportunity.
We're going to take this opportunity to take a very short break. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey. Our guest today is Dave Adelson and the whole Pacifica. We're going backwards to bring us up to date, and then we will go forwards also after break. What is the clarifying vision? To join us after break, you can call 510-848-4425, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our guest today is Dave Adelson, and our further guest today is the current status and present, you know, and then vision for the future of Pacifica. So we might want to condense also to bring us up to date, because we do want to address this issue of the opportunity, you know, Pacifica restored to a kind of experimental laboratory status, chance to pioneer new forms of governance, and the whole idea of lab elections as well, too. But to sort of dense that down, Dave Adelson, so in July 99, suit was filed.
Yeah, well, let me just tell this will go very quick. Basically,
okay.
The board was told that if they didn't, that Robert Coonrod, head of CPB, wrote an opinion letter saying that he thought that Pacifica's structure was in violation of Communications Act law that said that in no case shall LABs have control over day-to-day operations of the station, and an interpretation of the rules that said that LABs and local advisory boards and governing boards should remain distinct. And the purpose of that was to prevent interference by governing boards with advisory boards. But in any case, the opinion is shaky at best. Pacifica's structure predates even the Public Broadcasting Act, although it's in its current form it doesn't. But it certainly it is certain that we'd had this structure for 20 years. And we could have fought it, but the key people on the board chose not to fight it, but instead to use that opinion to force a change in bylaws, that led to the governing board just electing itself outright. And shortly after they did that, in February of 1990, and I should say that Coonrod has an interesting history. People should know that the heads of the major public broadcasting institutions in the U.S. both come out of the U.S. government's propaganda apparatus. Coonrod used to be in charge of radio and TV Marti. He was with Voice of America. And Kevin Close, who was head of NPR, he again may still be, comes out of the International Broadcasting Bureau, Radio Liberty, and the like. So that's important when you think about the model that's being imposed. But anyhow, Once the change in bylaws occurred in February of 99, it was very shortly after that that the National Board started coming down on Berkeley, removing Nicole Sawoya, and I think your listeners know quite a bit about the rest of the story. But the point was that we didn't see the teeth of the beast until after they believed that the legal door had been shut behind them and they couldn't be pursued.
Huh. But you, due to your diligent work starting in 1997, talking to lawyers, and then actually you said that you filed suit in July 99 within a day or two of the KPFA shutout.
Yeah, we filed on July 12th of 99.
And who's we?
That was 20 LAB members from four of the five stations. Actually, I'd started looking into the legal issues in March of 98 when they changed the rules of LABs and removed the voting rights of staff who were sitting on LABs, because it seemed to me that there was something wrong with that. I found a judge who gave me a legal intern, and we spent the summer going through corporations code. And so once they changed their bylaws in February, then it took a couple of months to basically be in contact with the other LABs, because there'd never been much in the way of contact between LABs. There had been a Council of Chairs call that had been a conference call that had been instituted in 98, and I had participated in a couple of those, so I was lucky enough to know the chairs of the other boards. And we set about putting it together, and then you had to write a letter notifying them of the violation and give them 30 days to respond. And so anyhow, we filed on July 12th, right as the station was being locked out, and the Michael Palmer memo suggesting selling KPFA and locking it down and reprogramming it. His email to Mary Berry was misdirected to Andrea Buffa of Media Alliance, one of the stars of this movement.
So there is magic.
There, you know, I said at the time, you know, God did this. And no one would, if you wrote it in a script, no one would ever believe it. How could you believe that right on the threshold of that happening, a smoking gun was delivered into the hands of, I mean, they clearly had been planning to reprogram it, because they had some tapes there, they had some people there in Berkeley. They were going to do it anyway. And I'll never forget getting this phone call of about midnight, I think it was a Tuesday night, from Andrea saying, we just got this email, we don't know if it's real, and then spending the whole night scrambling around, and talk about another coincidence, the very scrambling around to determine if it was authentic and tracing the tags and the router tags and all that. And what was amazing about it was that same next day, there was already a press conference scheduled for Media Alliance and for Andrea, because she and several other activists had been arrested doing a civil disobedience in front of the station, and I guess that was the day they were being arraigned. So then Dennis Bernstein had the audio of this news conference, at which she then read this memorandum that she'd just gotten the night before. I mean, just nobody's ever going to believe this.
No, they are. No, it's the Lou Hill synchronicity again. If we treat each other well, then synchronicity increases dramatically. And that intrinsic, I mean, in one of the beautiful things about the astrological language, it says, democracy, equality, synchronicity are linked. If one is devoted to real equality and dealing with people in a straight, equal manner, the rate of synchronicity will increase. I think it's a crucial principle that we say, yes, more of that, good.
Well, things can move around faster when there's a shallow gradient, you know, when you're not facing a lot of peaks and valleys.
Yes, I'm not sure I catch that image, but
if you're dealing in a hierarchical,
yes.
Think of it as a peak or a valley.
And right.
You have to move things up a hill.
Yes, we have fluidity. So it's the 6-year journey of this lawsuit, now settled, resolved, and great opportunity for really redirecting the network to its most dynamic, creative, influential edge, just in the nick of time when it is most needed. But let's go to our first caller, who's Robin in San Francisco. Come in, Robin.
Hi, I have a suggestion of what we could do as a community of KPFA listeners.
Please, go for it.
Yes. Talk about synchronicity. I guess you guys heard the George Bush fiasco of him choking on the pretzel and passing out.
No,
yes.
I didn't.
Yeah, you heard about that. And interesting, pretzels, by the way, talk about the mythos and the etymology. Pretzels are rope-shaped, biscuits twisted into a knot. You know, like enough rope to hang oneself. The real question might be, what was George Bush being told when he, you know?
No, I've got to say this because I've been ruminating on it since it happened, too. I mean, I think it's that we don't wish harm. I mean, there are people outside the White House now with banners, let's go, want a pretzel. But I think it's an admonitory lesson that if you put out imagery, it will come back to haunt you. If you keep talking about the noose is tightening around Al-Qaeda, then it's like, the Enron noose, I think, is what George Bush invoked upon himself. Anyway,
I think it was the Enron noose that, you know, this is going to be a second Watergate. We're not going to be able to put the cap on it. Anyway, my suggestion is, being that I'm one of these what you might call New Age activists that seeks to bring spirituality and politics together, especially through, let's say, random acts of kindness. So in that spirit, I'd like to suggest that we show how we feel about our president-elect by sending him bags of pretzels. And I would also suggest we don't send just any pretzels, but the Paul Newman organic pretzels. That way, we'll not only be making a political statement, but doing it organically. And,
I think that's good, and I think you're our teammate. Yes?
From the sale of Newman's pretzels go to charitable organizations, being his leftist politics, it means a worthy cause. I think we should call it Pretzels to the Prez campaign. The only drawback I see is that Jesus forbid that if he chokes again, being Newman's, you know, given Newman's well-known progressive politics, you know, he was number 19 on Nixon's enemies list, the left might be blamed and held responsible for his demise.
Yes, I think. Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Mario. Thank you, all the pseudonyms under which you ride the waves. That's fine. I think you might be the teammate for that particular bit of whimsy. Let's go to Jeff in Concord.
Hi, this is Jeff. I just want to say, first of all, I absolutely love your show. I live for it. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're completely welcome.
And it's one of the most refreshing things I've ever heard on the airwaves. And I've also, I'm 51 years old. I've been a supporter of various of the KPFA and KPFK stations, et cetera, since I was 9 years old. I used my lawn mowing money that summer to help donate for the station. Anyway, that's how strongly I'm passionate about it. I am wondering this. I know that there are huge debts that have been run up, and they've been run up by people who I believe were not just incompetent, but deliberately sought to harm the station, if not absolutely destroy one of the last bastions of free speech that I'm aware of. And I'm wondering if there's any way to hold them in any way accountable for having done this with the money that all of us worked so hard to make available.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and let's turn that to Dave. Yeah.
One of the there were a number of claims in the listeners' lawsuit that Carol Spooner organized and the Attorney General authorized, and our lawsuit, and I believe even in the director's lawsuit, there were a number of claims for use of funds other than those allowed for in the mission statement, and also for the failure. Individual directors are liable if they don't, it's hard to prove it, but if they don't exercise the due care that someone in like circumstance, a reasonable person in a like circumstance would exercise, then they can be personally liable. Of course, they're liable for any kind of self-dealing arrangements. Like, for example, John Murdoch's firm ran up, you know, at least $600,000 in bills. John Murdoch was on the national board. He's a partner in the firm, and it's a profit-sharing firm. So that's what can happen there. But in order to settle these suits and prevent this further hemorrhaging of money, and believe me, there were all sorts of things going on that will be coming to light in the coming weeks, we had to dismiss them from that liability. That was the only grounds on which they'd leave. And, you know, I think the, in addition to being malicious towards the original purposes of the mission, and there was a great deal of malice, I think, toward those initial purposes, and I think that's something that people need to think about. The what is it about that prior model of radio and its ability to affect the consciousness of people, even when the audiences are small by commercial radio standards, that is such a threat? I think people will understand it when they think about the effect it's had on their own life. But in addition to the maliciousness, I think that another part of it was the desire to mobilize one of these licenses. These licenses are extremely valuable. New York and Berkeley probably approach a couple of $100 million because their broadcast frequency is in the commercial part of the spectrum. And enormous debt could conceivably have impelled a sale. They were prohibited from, or they were limited in their ability to sell a station license by some stipulations that were negotiated following an injunction brought by the listener's lawsuit last March. And but if they could have basically been on the verge of bankruptcy, a couple things could have happened. One, they might have been able to justify a station sale. Two, to throw the institution into bankruptcy before the lawsuits were heard might have put a halt to the lawsuits and put it in the hands of a bankruptcy judge to determine what would happen to the assets. And so it was, I've always viewed it as a hostage situation.
Wow.
Which the hostage takers were really willing to do harm. I remember something Lauren Ayers told me. Lauren was on the local advisory board back in 99, and she was an original signatory to the LAB suit. And I was expressing outrage at the $500,000 that the Pacifica had spent on guards and on security firms and on PR firms during the KPFA lockout. And she said, you know what, Dave, that's the price of not having been vigilant. And I want to emphasize that because it's important for your listeners, those visionary activists, to understand the root principles that were used to really weaken this institution. You know, it's easy to talk about the bad guys and all the harm they did, but the institution itself had some internal contradictions, some weaknesses that made it vulnerable to that. And those are the things we have to root out. And we have to understand what is it about the original mission that had such a powerful promise for changing consciousness, and what is it about this new argument about relevance through ratings and money and increasing audience size that really undermines whatever those things were. I could talk about it, but I'd rather talk with listeners. I just want to say that Lou Hill never founded Pacifica in order to get a big average quarter hourly.
No, but it's also, I think what we can say is that this historical moment in time, there is a natural and huge constituency in the American public and maybe out there in the world that wants to connect. I mean, the thin veneer of, you know, just conformity and 90% approval of Bush is not true. There are people very hungry for it. And so the idea of absolutely making it available without compromise, but going, here's a voice, what a crucial synchronous and even perfect moment to go, yes, extending influence without compromise through creativity and embracing, you know, what a good idea. So those $3 to $4 million huge debts are largely legal and PR run up by the old board, yes?
Yeah, well, when we talk about $3 to $4 million, well, the $3 million that I heard over the weekend at the national board meeting have to do with bills that have come in the last 90 days.
For what?
We don't know. A lot of legal bills, a lot of PR firms.
A lot of pizza.
But other things. I mean, the money that was set aside for KPFK's transmitter upgrade project has seemingly been swallowed by this whole thing. I just want to say, you know, in the whole course of our suit, the LAB suit, we spent, I think, on the order of $180,000. That's in 2.5 years. In the 3 months since Bessie Wash, the prior executive director, fired the law firm of Epstein, Becker & Green and Wendell, Dean, Rosen & Black, in August, when they were trying to settle with us, and hired two new law firms, one of which included the attorney who was Clinton's attorney,
right,
in the Lewinsky impeachment scandal. In those 3 months, those two firms that they hired ran up bills in excess of $500,000 in 3 months, and then they subsequently settled with us.
We will take this to heart. We will be vigilant. We will be observant. We will declare. We will clarify our vision. And here to help us do it is our next caller, Joshua in Berkeley. Come in.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you so much for this show. It's so needed. I think this urge to connect, community that people have, is so strong right now. And KPFA is in this incredibly potent position of being the only link that our communities have to have any kind of communication amongst each other. Like, I've been going back and forth from Sonoma County to Berkeley, and tonight the sun's been setting in these very clear days here, right? It's just kind of shifting over in the northern part of the Golden Gate, and I was thinking how, you know, the counties to the north, like we saw when we held our first meeting in the park in Sebastopol on a Sunday morning, and when 300 people showed up, we knew that there was some incredibly potent urge in people to protect this radio station. And one of the things that I'm hoping for in this next cycle of activity is that somehow representation of the northern counties and of the outlying districts, which now support the station as much as Berkeley, get voices onto the station.
Yeah.
And toward that end, I'm making a proposal to the Program Council in the next few weeks to initiate an all-night talk show, which I hope to give voice to many, many people all over the Bay Area. You know, it was fantastic. I was down answering in the phone room during the marathon. Calls were coming in from K-Mud up in Humboldt County because Amy Goodman had just been on, and people were subscribing up in it who couldn't even listen to the station, trying to KPFA because they value so much the absolute distinctiveness of what the station has to offer. And I think that one thing that people need to know is that there's an incredible struggle still ahead of us in terms of how are we going to learn to work together in some kind of forms of democracy and,
yes,
and heal all the differences between us, but still working toward this common good of getting out this, because KPFA has a radius of 6.5 million people, and the people are we're hungry for communion and for content and for meaning and for spirit engaged in activism. It's it's really the time now, and it's such a hopeful time. And
may I address a couple of points you made?
Please. Thanks very much, Joshua, because we want to go right on to democracy issues that you brought up.
Yeah,
yes, Dave.
A couple of things. First of all, I've been arguing for a couple of years that people ought not be stopped when thinking of democracy at thinking of elections. Elections are just a mechanism. Democracy means you have an ability to affect the things that affect you. And so, really, we don't want to just vote once in a while for the people who will be our rulers and hope that they will do what we want. We want, I think what I heard the Joshua saying is, we want an opportunity to actually have our creative energies engaged. And I've been thinking about ways of doing that, things like ongoing listener ratings of the programming. But Michael Zinzin, who's on our board on our local board down here, a former Black Panther who now works with the Coalition Against Police Abuse and was instrumental in brokering some of the gang truce work that's gone on been involved in the gang truce down here in L.A., has been arguing for some remote studios around the Signal area, because L.A. is very segregated. It's very segregated racially, geographically. And, you know, if you want to talk about community radio, you want to have certain things going on in your community, for your community. WBIX, the web radio station that was started up in BAI for the producers in exile, they have a mobile remote unit. They have a bus that's outfitted, and they can do live remotes. They were covering the national board meeting. We want to set up here in L.A. studios in various places around town. It doesn't take that much. And I think that I would like to see Pacifica make a commitment to web stream whatever the people who go through their training programs produce. And then, rather than having to ask a program council to consider producing a show, support the production of shows, and then the audience that really cares about that show, when there's brilliance there, then the program director can draw on that brilliance. Whether somebody's consistently brilliant or only occasionally brilliant, you know, you air them consistently or occasionally. One of the things we've talked, one of the problems with Blues Hill's vision is sometimes in reaching for brilliance you fail. And we don't want to have it be, not to mean any disrespect, but to be amateur hour, because the space is so valuable. But we should be constantly working to engage and promote the use of people's energy. And Matthew Lazar said, the historian of Pacifica, that if we think that we just got Pacifica back and now we're fine, we're wrong. This victory has to be the launching point for expanding opportunities for democratic communication in a variety of ways. And you'll know we're winning when your ideas, not to have somebody else do something, but to allow you to do some work, are welcomed and promoted.
Excellent. Actually, what a good idea. But also, just to clarify, too, the distinction between, say, on-air show and web stream, can web stream simulcast a number of different shows?
Yes. Yes, there's no limit on that.
Aha, uh-huh. What a good idea.
There's not 168 hours in a week on the web. There's as many as you need. And just like KPFA started up in what was then wasteland, people didn't have FM receivers when KPFA started. They bought them because what was going on KPFA was important enough to buy a receiver so you could hear it. And with respect to web streaming, even though there's a limited population that has access to that, as stuff comes out and is there that isn't elsewhere, people will gravitate towards it.
That's great. And then also just I was talking to a colleague, Jamie Yeager, a frequent guest also, too, about pioneering new forms of governments, too. I mean, we'd mentioned, you and I, Dave, in speaking last night also, too, that this is a rare strategical opportunity, and many things could happen, good or bad, but the lab elections are kind of crucial. And Jamie and I were talking about, what does that mean? Who gets to vote, you know? And I think it would be, you know, whoever listens gets to vote. Because if you have it, whoever gives money, then you're back to a Republican thing, you know, a dollar equals a vote, you know? And I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but the idea that everyone would vote by mail. Is that one of your thoughts?
Well, apparently there's some history in listener elections in different stations. Apparently, stations where they threw it open to any listenership to vote have actually been subject to takeover attempts by, for example, Christian groups who organized their membership and tried to take over in that way. But I, you know, I personally think that there are different levels of relationship to the station. There's listening, there's subscribing, and there's volunteering or doing work. And I think each of those has different sorts of levels of interest. So I always gravitate towards complexity. And let's put it this way. I think it has to get worked out by the listeners in that signal area and in each signal area what kind of arrangement they want to have, what kind
about
of...
Who votes and what the voting mechanism is.
I mean, I'm not prepared to... I've always thought that the elections were actually one of the simpler tasks before us, and so so many people were paying attention to them that I decided to address myself to things that other people weren't doing, like developing mission ratings things like that.
Mission ratings meaning listeners write in to go, this is good, this is not, so this is what?
Well, how do you... the problem in non-commercial radio is if people have different civic values... fundamentally different civic values, how do you arbitrate those differences? The easiest way is to say we're going to use the commercial values of how many people are listening at a given moment and how much money do they give, because that's objective. So all other things being equal, the people who maximize that, which is what we've been having, will end up having more decision-making power ultimately. We have to say if we value diversity in a real sense, then how do we make agreements about whether something's meeting the promise it's intended to meet? And I think we need a mission rating. We've got lots of other commercial ratings metrics. We need metrics that everybody can agree on that makes them willing to protect the station because it's doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Good. Well, let's go for further counsel to our next caller, Werner in Oakland.
Thank you, Carolyn and David. I'm really happy to be on. I have a suggestion for updating the Pacifica mission statement. Divide the public affairs program into three parts. Number one, muckraking like Dennis Bernstein. Number two, visionary activism. What kind of a future we want to build for ourselves. And number three, tactics for bringing that about. I think that's really important. We need to be more positive than we have been. We need to have people be more hopeful, like socialism used to be in the past, and a vision of the kind of future we want in all fields, health, education, economic activity. There's a website called ceri.net. On how to do manufacturing with no waste products.
Wonderful. Anyway. No, we're out now, Werner, but those are excellent things to end on. I know you'll be back next week when we reconvene. Thank you very much, Dave Adelson, for this illuminating storytelling, gathering our force and our wits. And, you know, say a wish that you would want us to all go woof to.
Oh, say a wish. Let's see.
Rededicated vision.
I guess what I'd want to say... It's hard.
Uh-oh.
It's hard on a quick notice. There's so much.
Sorry.
I guess what I want to say is, come up with your best suggestions and don't just sit on them. Write them in, because the best ideas are ultimately going to be heard.
Excellent. Thanks always to producer Sally Phillips and DC engineer Andy York, and always to our wonderful and less beleaguered Jim Bennett, Shadow World Governor for Betterment of World, and thanks always to Berkeley Board Op Lisa Ballard. Splendid job trying interesting, challenging circumstances, and to all of us, compassionate tricksters and the wild blooming of the compassionate trickster heart and rededicated vision. We are the voice of the strong, dynamic peace movement. Woof.